Welcome to Dare to Struggle, Dare to Win, a monthly podcast by the U.S. Human Rights Network addressing human rights issues in the United States. This month's podcast examines the human rights implications of the recent federal debates about U.S. government debt and the debt ceiling.
We're here today with James Hines, Associate Director and Associate Research Professor at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and Radhika Balakrishnan, the Executive Director for the Center for Women's Global Leadership and Professor Women's and Gender Studies at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I want to thank the two of you for joining us today. And we start with our first question. What is the debt ceiling, and why is it getting so much attention in the federal budget debates between Congress and the President?
Okay, so the debt ceiling. According to the U.S. Constitution, Congress has to approve any type of borrowing by the federal government. And just to be clear, the government borrows by issuing bonds, government bonds, which are effectively IOUs. Whoever holds the bonds will get paid back by the government. And instead of having Congress vote on every single time the Treasury issues bonds, what it does is it sets a debt ceiling, which kind of automatically approves any bond issues up to a point. And once you reach that debt ceiling, then Congress has to approve a higher debt ceiling. And what usually happens is that the debt ceiling is almost automatically increased whenever a budget is passed. So it's really common in the past to have the debt ceiling increased. During the Reagan administration, it happened 18 times. During George Bush Jr.'s administration, it happened 7 times. During Clinton's administration, it happened 5 times. So it's not an uncommon occurrence, but we usually never hear about it because it's all wrapped up in the budget process. Why it's become a big issue now is that the government needs to finance the commitments that it's made in the past. And basically, the government currently has a cash flow problem. It's kind of running out of cash to make the payments that are coming up. And so what's happened is the Republican-dominated House has kind of seized on this opportunity, and the debt ceiling has to be increased in order for the government to have the cash to meet its obligations. The Republican dominated House has kind of seized on this opportunity to turn it into a whole debate on the future of the budget. The Republicans demanding massive spending cuts in the future in order to raise the debt ceiling, and the Obama administration's proposal of higher taxes and spending cuts, kind of a combination of the two. But it's because that Congress has to approve government spending, additional government borrowing, that this has kind of come to a head.
So when people are talking about the U.S. defaulting on this debt, you know, what is this meaning? How serious is it? Is it as serious as it's being made out in the mainstream media?
Okay, again, as I said, the government's kind of facing a cash flow problem, if the debt ceiling isn't increased, the government has to find a way of making payments. And some of those payments are payments on the debt itself, so the payments to the bondholders. There's other payments the government makes routinely, such as Social Security payments, for instance. So the default, when people are talking about a default, what they're saying is that if the government runs out of cash and can't make these payments, what it's going to do is not make the payments to the bondholders, and that's going to constitute a default on the debt. But I think it's really important to recognize that this is kind of a politically created scarcity. It's a politically created shortage that's out there. That normally the debt ceiling would be automatically increased in these cases. The default isn't that the U.S. government is suddenly insolvent. That the economy is in such a crisis that it just can't meet its obligations. But it's being created through this maneuver by the Republican-dominated House. It's also, I think, important to recognize that the government has other options other than defaulting on the debt. It can get cash from other sources. It could delay certain payments that it's making. So in, again, the kind of the focus on the default is really a way of kind of making this issue sound a lot worse than what it really is, and trying to make it sound as if there's some kind of fundamental economic problem there, when really it's just a political maneuver by Congress right now.
Mm-hmm. Kali, I just wanted to add to that is that the political maneuver is also, I mean, they're using this moment in which they have control over the debt ceiling to reconfigure what the government's supposed to do, you know, in terms of the cuts in spending. They're trying to rename what the role of the state is, and, you know, cutting spending, cutting entitlements, making that the main part of their agenda is a political agenda. And as James said, it's not really the debt. They're using it as a maneuver to come up with an incredibly reactionary role of the government.
So let's talk about that just a little bit further. I mean, one of the key things that they put forward is this proposed balanced budget amendment. You know, what is a balanced budget amendment, and, you know, how would that, if it's instituted on a federal level, how would that impact the government's ability, the federal government's ability to operate and to kind of live up to its various economic and social obligations?
Go ahead, Dave.
Okay, the balanced budget amendment would just put a constraint on the federal government so that it couldn't spend more than it takes in revenues. And it's important to recognize that at the state level, this exists in every single state in the U.S., except for the state of Vermont. But that's just kind of an accident of history. So states have a balanced budget requirements. The problem with the federal government having a balanced budget crisis is if you run into a balanced budget requirement is if you run into a crisis like we had beginning in 2008, tax revenues drop very, very rapidly. And so what a balanced budget amendment would mean in that context is that the government would have to either drastically raise taxes at that point or cut spending in order to make sure that spending comes in line with the amount of revenues it has. So in the case of an economic crisis, cutting spending dramatically when you already have a crisis is going to make that crisis a lot worse. Or jacking up taxes when you have a crisis can also make that crisis work. So it would really limit the government's ability to use its budget as a way of dealing with these crises that happen in the private sector.
If this is part of the political spin, why are they pushing it so hard now? You want to tackle that, Radhika?
Yeah, well, just to add on to what James just said is that, you know, the role of government spending, I mean, the way it's being articulated in the media is as though it's a household, right, that you don't borrow more than you have. And that's not what a government does. I mean, it's not a household. The government is something different, which is that when you have a downturn in the economy or a crisis in the economy, what the government does is it spends money in order to increase jobs, which then creates revenue. So it's not like, you know, I don't have enough money and therefore I'm going to go buy a car. When the government, as James said, when it goes into a downturn, people lose jobs, so there's not enough taxes coming in. So there's going to be a decrease in the amount of money the government gets. And there's going to be an increase in the amount of money it has to spend because more people are going to ask for entitlements, unemployment insurance, all of those things. And so borrowing money in moments of a downturn is the right thing to do. But they pretend as though it's a household who's spending beyond its means. And the government's role is to spend to stimulate the economy so that there are more jobs and people pay more taxes, and therefore it's the role of the stimulus package, right? We would be in so much bigger trouble if we didn't have that stimulus package, even though it wasn't enough. And so I think that's the way we have to and a balanced budget amendment would say that if there's a downturn, as James said, you have to raise taxes or you're going to cut spending because you have to make sure you spend only what you have.
So I want to come back to this question of the debt, because so much is really being made of that in the media right now. Does anyone in our economy benefit from the debt? I mean, how should we approach that? How we want to get people to understand that from a human rights perspective?
Okay, so the debt, I think it is important to pay attention to the debt, and there are some real issues there. It's not a question that the debt can necessarily automatically increase without limit, without having some types of impacts. So what are some of the real issues if we're just thinking about the debt? One is that if you have higher and higher levels of debt, you have to pay interest on that debt. And that interest comes out of the budget. And so as those interest payments get bigger and bigger, they can actually start squeezing out other areas of government spending at that time. Where do those interest payments go? Well, they go to all the people who bought those bonds in the first place. And so a high level of interest payment on the debt is actually a transfer of resources from the government to the bondholders. And the bondholders are going to be, they're investment firms, there's banks, there's a lot of foreign central banks that hold U.S. bonds. And so often it's a transfer kind of the wealth holders of society. So I think it's important to recognize that. I also would think we have to make sure that we ask, you know, when you do borrow money, what is the money actually being used for? If you borrow money in order to stimulate investment and create jobs and kind of lay a foundation for future growth, then you're getting a return on that borrowing. You're getting something back from it. If the borrowing is used to finance non-productive activities, such as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's unclear that we're going to get any benefits back, long-term benefits back from that type of spending. And so that's important to take into account. So I think it's important when we're talking about the debt to kind of think of the role of the debt in a crisis situation to try to get us out of that crisis, you know, the types of issues Radhika just spoke about, where it plays a fundamental role in doing that, is different than kind of long-term debt. You know, the building up debts during good times doesn't necessarily make sense. We saw the debt rise under George Bush Jr. with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan during a period of an economic boom. We shouldn't be borrowing to finance those type of activities. If you want to finance more government spending during a boom, you should raise taxes, and you should raise taxes on the rich as opposed to borrowing money. Again, why is that the case? It's because when you borrow money, you're making a long-term commitment to pay interest to bondholders, which is a transfer away from the government to wealth holders in our society. So I think there's a whole set of issues around the debt, including some really good concerns about not wanting the debt to get out of control. But we have to see it within the current situation where we are, 9% unemployment, 1 out of 7 U.S. households on food stamps, you know, the real situation, and what really are the policy priorities. You know, haggling about the debt ceiling, I don't think should top the priority list right now.
Yeah, and I would add that the debt during George Bush Jr. was the two wars, but all the tax cuts for the rich.
Yeah,
you know, the
absolutely.
Tax to GDP ratio dropped like crazy because of all the tax cuts for the rich. No one's questioning that debt, you know, and why that debt increased in a time of boom. And it, you know, and inequality in this country is unprecedented.
So I wanted to shift gears just a little bit and bring in more from the human rights perspective into this conversation. The two of you just recently produced a report called Maximum Available Resources and Human Rights. Could you explain to our audience what this concept of maximum available resources is and how it relates to the current budget debate?
Yeah, the concept of maximum available resources is a concept that comes out of human rights norms. And what it says is that the government, as a human rights obligation, has to use its resources or generate resources to its maximum available ability. And the report we wrote was trying to address what that actually means. And in the sort of literature in human rights, what it has in the past been interpreted as that whatever money you have, as the budget that you have to spend it in accordance with economic and social rights obligations. So, you know, spend it on housing and health and all the and food and other economic and social rights obligations. What we did in our report was actually say, well, you know what, we can't just say that whatever budget you have to spend. How do you actually get that budget? You know, how does the money, how does the government actually raise its resources? And so in that, we decided to look at sort of issues about, you know, how does the government generate revenue? We looked at issues of taxation, revenue generation, debt and deficit, and for international issues, development assistance, and monetary policy. And so in this report, we kind of go in and look at how does the government actually generate resources, and then look at how does it spend it. And I think it's very pertinent to the current debate because the government actually has an obligation to use its resources to a maximum level to fulfill economic and social rights. And if anybody's interested in that report, it's on the Center for Women's Global Leadership's website, and I think the U.S. Human Rights Net website as well.
One particular piece within that framework we wanted to talk about and really try to explain, because it's I know in some of our trainings it's really come up and been kind of an energizing point when folks kind of talk about budgets and understanding budgets from a human rights perspective. And it's this concept of non-retrogression and the government's obligation to not go backwards on its commitments. How would that play out? You know, should there be a default, and should there be kind of a capitulation to the demands of the Republicans in this budget debate?
I mean, non-retrogression basically means that in economic and social rights, unlike civil and political rights, in civil and political rights, those are immediate rights. In economic and social rights, if we say that there's a right, let's say, I mean, the problem in the United States is we don't have a huge amount of economic and social rights, but we have to hold them accountable to it, even though they haven't signed the treaties, is that if you're moving towards the right, let's say, to food, then you have to keep moving towards that right so that it's not immediate, but you have to keep moving towards it, and you have to show that your policies are trying to move towards the right to food, let's say. And retrogression means that you're cutting spending away from that right, and so there's an obligation to non-retrogression. You're not allowed to cut back on what you have. And an example, I'm using the example of food just because there's some interesting information and data on food insecurity in the U.S., and what you see is just a huge increase in food insecurity in the United States because of this current crisis. I mean, there's more and more families that are food insecure, and it was, you know, it went up by, I forget, like 70, it's up to about 17%, 17 million households in the U.S. were food insecure at some time during 2009, and that went up from before the crisis. So there, it's an obvious thing of retrogression. People are more food insecure now than they were in 2007, and therefore we can hold the government accountable to saying, what is your policy that more and more households are food insecure? And, you know, so many children are food insecure. What kind of country do we live in where we have children who are, you know, not sufficiently eating well? So that's an example of non-retrogression, but you can also think about housing, you can think about health, access to health. All of that means that the government should be moving towards better access to those and not cutting it. And often, you know, they talk about the budget as a reason, you know, there's a crisis, so we can't fulfill that. Well, we need to hold them accountable, especially in moments of a downturn, is when people need more government intervention so that they're you know, what James just said, 1 in 7 Americans are on food stamps, and they're talking about cutting food stamps. What does that mean in terms of their obligation to the people who live in this country?
And just to come back to that whole issue of the balanced budget, the proposed balanced budget amendment, and to think of that in terms of this issue of non-retrogression, what a policy like that would do would be to force the federal government to act in ways that lead to this regression of human rights in the event of an economic downturn, because it would basically legislate that the government would have to cut these benefits whenever we had an economic downturn. So using kind of the human rights language and the human rights framework, we can really develop a strong case against the balanced budget amendment on the grounds of non-retrogression and the obligation of governments to not go back on rights once they have been achieved.
All right, so for our final question, just want to ask, so you know, our audience listening to this can engage in kind of more practical ways. How would you recommend that the human rights movement in the United States engage these debates on the budget, the debt and debt ceiling and the balanced budget amendment? What should people be demanding and what should they be organizing?
Well,
go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I would say the first thing is to make sure that they understand what these debates are about.
Yes.
And get knowledgeable, because I think most people, you know, think economics, oh, that's not for me. And I think the way in which the Tea Party and the right wing have kind of explained it, it makes sense, right? Don't spend more than you have. And I think the complicated thing is that the government has to spend more than what they have. So the first is to get educated on these issues and know what all of the kind of problems are in the debate. The second would be that to look at it historically. I mean, as I think both James and I have said, you know, in moments of crisis, that's when you need to spend money. And so I argue for it and not cut social spending when people need it the most, right? I mean, when we're in a crisis is when people need it the most. And really push for job creation, because that's what we need. Not over 9% people are unemployed, and God knows how many more who've sort of disaffected and left the labor force. We need the budget and the government to stimulate jobs that supports ordinary people so that they can get back to work, and hold businesses and banks accountable for this mess that they created. I mean, this isn't something that landed from the universe. I mean, it was a, you know, constructed crisis. And so we need to hold the banks accountable. And somehow right now there's nothing talking about what the banks did and how we got into this.
Yeah, instead of all the adjustment is, you know, in terms of, you know, the social programs that benefit, you know, the vast majority of Americans, whether it's unemployment insurance, whether it's basic education, whether it's Medicaid or Medicare, and all of that. And we're told repeatedly, you know, there's no money out there. There's no money out there in the economy. That's why we have to do these cuts. But, you know, the federal government and the Federal Reserve in the U.S. was bailing out the financial sector for a long time. And if you look at the financial sector, there's actually a lot of money there right now. If you look at the banks in the U.S., the current level of just cash that's sitting around that they're holding on to is $1.4 trillion right now. That's $1.4 trillion. It's twice. It's nearly twice the size of the stimulus. You know, it dwarfs the types of spending that, you know, they say now needs to be cut. And so I think there's a real need to kind of push back on this issue, push back that all the adjustments have to be made by us, that all the adjustments have to be in terms of, you know, it's
be seen as, you know, people borrowing beyond their means, living beyond their means in terms of education or health care. It's just not true. And to push back that there's no resources out there, there are resources out there. And we need to be able to point to them and hold these businesses and the banks accountable for sitting on this stockpile of cash while, you know, people are going hungry and homeless.
James, just in terms of the number you put out in terms of $1.3 trillion, it might be useful to just give a context of what it was 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, so we're just talking about this is a banking system, and the banks are required to hold some cash on account. They have accounts just like you'll have a deposit account, and they have accounts. They hold their accounts at the Federal Reserve, which is kind of the big central banking institution of the U.S. and is part of the U.S. government. And so currently in those accounts that they have at the Federal Reserve, they have $1.4 trillion on accounts. Before the crisis, if you look back to 2007, the amount that they held on account was about $20 billion. So they're holding, what is that, over 50 times what they used to hold on account. And this is just surplus cash that's just sitting there. And we really need, and this is just one example of some of the hypocrisies and the imbalances in our current economic situation. We just really need to be able to start naming that and bringing these issues into the debate a lot more. And what I feel is happening is that you create there's the kind of a smokescreen that's being created in terms of talking about debt ceilings and defaults and scaring people by that and using these scare tactics to get people to support positions that, you know, are contrary to their own interests. And we really need to start fighting that level of misinformation that's out there.
All right. What I want to just pass on to everyone where they can find the report, Maximum Available Resources and Human Rights, developed by Radhika, Diane Ellison, James Hines, and Nicholas Lasani. You can find it at www.cwgl.rutgers.edu/global-center/publications/MAR-report. That PDF, and you can also find it on the U.S. Human Rights Network's website, which is www.ushrnetwork.org. James and Radhika, I want to thank you. Hopefully, as this debate proceeds, we can follow up and gain some more clarity. I know folks are definitely going to be asking about this. It's a hot topic and something I think a lot of us who are not economists are trying to grapple it and understand and make some sense of. So be looking forward to talking to you again.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Carly.
The U.S. Human Rights Network is dedicated to building a people-centered human rights movement in the United States. For more information about the network and how to become a member, visit www.ushrnetwork.org. We also want to hear your feedback. Get in touch with us by emailing info@ushrnetwork.org. Thanks for listening to Dare to Struggle, Dare to Win. Join us next month.